You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakulia, Tilitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
Goodbye, 이별을 알았다면 그토록 사랑하지 말 걸 그랬나 봐요.
Check it out, y'all. 해져가는 서로의 감정 때문에 상처를 주는 것조차도 이제 무덤덤한 우리 이미 사랑은 떠났고 정밖에 남지 않아서 그냥 그런가 하고 뜨뜻이 지근해졌지. 관심은 집착이 되어버리고 웃음은 거의 밥 먹듯이 해. 너와 내가 쌓았던 신뢰랑성은 무너지고 넌 이제 이별길을 걸으며 새 사람을 찾지.
같이 울기 위해 널 만난 건 아닌데
눈물이 난다.
상처받기 위해 쌓은 추억이 아닌데
잊혀져간다.
너무 쉽게 또한 사람과 남이 돼. 고작 이별하기 위해 널 사랑한 건
계속 간다.
작다 여태어만 이별 길에 나를 떠나 부디 꽃길만 걸어요. 조심히 가요. 외로운 이별 길을 가는 길 나의 모든 기억을 버려요.
Check it out. 지나간 기억 속에서 산다는 건 그 얼마나 무기력한 외로움일까. 그 기억 속에서조차 잊혀진다는 건 또 어떤 순간보다 잔인한 아픔인가. 죽도록 사랑할 것만 끝내 나 죽지 않았네. 숨을 깊게 들이마셔도 내뱉으면 한숨이 돼. 누구나 하는 이별이니 우리 슬퍼 말아요. 난 또 그대 닮은 듯 아닌 사람 찾아갈게.
같이 울기 위해 널 만난 건 아닌데
눈물이 난다.
상처받기 위해 쌓은 추억이 아닌데
잊혀져간다.
너무 쉽게 또한 사람과 남이 돼. 고작 이별하기 위해 널 사랑한 건 아닌데
익숙해져간다.
그토록 사랑하지 말 걸 그랬나 봐요.
그랬나 봐요.
Goodbye, goodbye. 어차피 떠난다면 어떤 미련도 남지 않게 보란 듯이 살아.
저만 지나도 숨쉬는 너라서 이런 느낌을 숨길 수가 없는 거야. 조각조각 나버렸어 그렇지. 흔적의 신호를 잡아서 가면 너를 찾을 수 있어.
우리 기억을 걷다가 한 걸음이 가까워져 너를 더 원하지만 맘에 놓인 너의 꿈이기에 너의 불빛을 놓아 내가 슬겨서
다른 차원에서
내게
Hello. 너의 발자취 난 그 길을 계속 걷지. 너의 숨결이 남겨져 쫓아 따라가지. 나에게 닿기를 진하게 배인 향기를 다시 마주하기를 날 찾기를 바로 오늘 너에게만.
우리 기억을 걷다가 한 걸음이 가까워져 너를 더 원하지만 맘에 너무
다른 차원에서
내게 보낸다.
Say goodbye.
Say 손끝에 모든 메시지 넣어. Say goodbye. 나의 차원에 숨긴 너의 모든 흔적. 너도 나와 똑같다면 나의 조각을 찾는 그날 내 눈앞에 나타나줘. 내가 기다리고 있을게.
언제까지나 난 이 자리에 내가 눈 떴을 때 내 눈앞에 네가 있어줘. 네가 있어줘.
너에게 보낸다.
Say goodbye.
Say goodbye. 나의 손끝에 모든 메시지 넣어. Say goodbye. Say goodbye.
나의 차원에 숨긴 너의 모든 흔적.
And that was "이별길 Goodbye Road" by Icon from the album "New Kiss the Final," which was followed by "Signal" by Newest. And you're listening to K-Pop Cafe on CITR 101.9 FM, and your DJ Jaden is back on the mic right here with a special guest here today at the studio. He is the head of the Asian Studies Department at UBC, teaching Korean language and literature as a professor. He's by far one of the most representative figures who have contributed to expanding the Korean language program worldwide and helping students enrich their interest in studying the language. And I know some of you guys who are listening to this show are interested in studying the Korean language, and some of you are actually listening to the other show that I do on Wednesday from 1 to 2, Korean Wave, which I do in Korean to practice your listening skills and also picking up some of the phrases that I say on air. So yeah, so I thought it would be a great idea to have Professor Ross King here. So please welcome Professor Ross King. Hi, Professor.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, could you give us a brief introduction of yourself?
Brief introduction, sure. Well, my name is Ross King. I've been teaching at UBC in the Department of Asian Studies for 23 years, since 1995. Mm. My main focus is language and literature, and increasingly pre-modern, pre-20th century, old stuff, especially stuff in Hanmun, in classical Chinese. Mm. And I'm basically interested in anything and everything that has to do with the way Koreans have dealt with language and writing for the last 2,000 years.
Right. Mm. And I think the last time we met was last year, early 2017, during the Lunar New Year event at the Asian Studies building.
Okay.
I think that was the last time we saw.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. How have you been doing after
that?
Well,
I mean, after that, I went away on sabbatical for a year. And I was in Korea for most of it at Sungkyunkwan University.
Yeah.
Which is one of only two universities inside the old gates of old Seoul.
Right.
The other one being Dongukdae, which is a Buddhist university, mm. and so the location is really good.
Right.
So we, our apartment was looking right over the P1, you know, the secret yeah. garden, and nice location. So we had a good year. Yeah, came back in June.
Mm. Were you in Seoul most of the time?
Pretty much. A few trips to satellite cities, but otherwise mostly in Seoul. Yeah.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And yeah. So 교수님 같은 이제 분을 모시게 돼서 되게 영광이고요. And yeah, I hope everyone listening to this show will get to know more about the current situation of the Korean language program nowadays and be encouraged to study Korean through this show today. And yeah, so yeah. And the first question I have for you, Professor, is that so basically most of the people who are listening to this show, they are listening to it because they love K-pop or they just love Korean pop music. And some of them are actually listening to this show to actually... Because they're actually passionate about listening, like learning the language. And in fact, I know that some of the people who, like some of my friends who are listening to this show, they also listen to Korean Wave. I do on Wednesday. Right. Yeah. I mentioned it on top. So some of the people and also myself are wondering what was the motivation for you personally that you made you want to study Korean?
Sure. It's kind of a long story, but I'll keep it short. And in general... I still, to this day, Koreans, especially Koreans my age, you know, old, a lot older than you are, kind of look at me and go, why? You know, why of all things? Where have Pirimyeon? Where have Pirimyeon? Korean. Because they still find it kind of hard to believe that any foreigner would really be that interested in their language and culture. Mm. Although, of course, now that's changed because of K-pop. But so when I was your age, when I was in university, most universities did not teach Korean. I was an undergraduate at Yale in the U.S. They did not teach Korean at the time. And that's where I started. But when I first went to Korea, I'm going to skip back and forth in time a little bit. When I first went to Korea, this is 1981, I think.
81.
So, you know, I would meet Koreans and they, you know, they'd say, what are you doing here? And I'd say, I'm learning Korean. And they would go like, why? And then there were automatically four questions they would ask me. They would say, oh, are you a missionary?
Oh, okay.
Right. And I'd say, no. And they say, are you U.S. military? Nope.
Like 주한미군.
Are you, what's the other? Are you Peace Corps? Are you a Peace Corps volunteer? Because there's a whole generation of Korean studies professors now that basically started in the Peace Corps.
Right.
But no, I wasn't. And then the last question would always be, are you with the CIA? So in other words, this is now 30-some years ago, but at that point in time, that was the only reasons that Koreans could think of that an American, and I was originally an American, would want to learn Korean. But in my case, I was kind of a language freak starting from middle school, age 11. I started 11? Spending every summer in the summers going to basically to language immersion camp. And I was learning Spanish. I was learning Russian. I was learning German. I was taking French in school. So all through high school, during regular school year, I was taking lots of foreign languages, all European. And then in the summers, spending all my summers in northern Minnesota, in the Minnesota North Woods, going to language camp. So then about age 14, my parents, who are English, and very, very English in the sense that they spent their whole lives, I think, as kids in boarding schools, they said, oh, time for our kids to go to boarding school. I was living in a small town in Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
A very boring small town, basically full of white people, very no diversity whatsoever. And then they sent me away to boarding school on the East Coast. In New Hampshire, very famous one. Every morning at 10, from 10 to 10:30 a.m., we had assembly. And we sat alphabetically. And so my last name is King. To my left, there was a whole string of Kims sitting next to me. And to my right, there was a whole string of Lees. And to my just behind me, one of my classmates, David Moon, was sitting. And sort of just ahead of me, one row to the left, was David Hyun. And then right in front of me was Chini Jun, J-U-H-N. I was surrounded by Koreans, Korean Americans, like 1.5 gen, some of them second gen. And I sort of kept looking around going, who are these Koreans? You know? and then as soon as I got to college, when I went to Yale, I started taking Japanese because I wanted to start, because they did teach Japanese, not Korean.
Right.
And just to sort of get away from European languages and do something new.
Asian.
And then the professor in charge of that program was actually also a professor who did research on Korean. And so he got me interested. Kind of. So basically there was kind of a personal angle through like being surrounded by these Korean kids in high school. And then a kind of the intellectual side of it once I started going to college and this professor who was in charge of the Japanese program, you know, say, hey, you should also try Korean. And he actually found the money for me to go to Korea the first time I went in the summer. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
When I was after my second year.
I see.
So yeah, it's kind of a combination of personal and intellectual reasons. But I started through language and as kind of a language freak.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, no K-pop. And K-pop was not
back
around then.
Right.
No, no.
Mm.
But I will say that when I, you know, got to Korea and really started studying Korean hard on my own, the one thing that helped me the most in terms of nailing a good you know, pronunciation and especially intonation was listening to talk radio.
The radio?
Korean talk radio. Yeah, yeah, that was really good.
Okay. Do you remember who you listened to?
Oh, I do not.
Oh, no?
That was a long time ago. I listened to just anything and everything. I just spent, you know, the whole day listening to radio while
radio?
I was studying. And, you know, in the background is kind of just background noise. And it's really helpful.
Right, yeah. That's how I basically, like, learned English as well. Like, when I came here, like, to Canada for the first time, like, back in 2009, like, I basically had, like, whenever I did something, like, on the desk, I basically had the radio on.
CNN
on, just, you know, just keep listening to
that. It's really helpful.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, now learners, learners of Korean today have way more resources at their disposal, like through the web and, you know, internet resources is good stuff now. But back then, there was, you know, hardly even any textbooks. You know?
Right, yeah. And nowadays, even people, even the Koreans who want to study English or English-speaking people want to study Korean, there are so many websites online. They can watch the shows with subtitles on the bottom. It's like so easy to find everywhere.
And Korea is kind of good that way because you know, as you know, if you go on the subway in Seoul, because no one can hear the sound anyway because it's so noisy. All of the shows, you know, even for Koreans have chamak, in Korean, and it's, so you get this kind of multi, you know, modal attack. It's really helpful for learners. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Wow. But thanks for sharing your personal story, though. I never thought of that at all. Yeah.
It's kind of different. Everybody older than me, all of the professors in the business, you know, of Korean studies that are just above me, they're all one of those four categories I mentioned. But most of them are Peace Corps.
Right.
And then I was kind of like the first person to become a professor in Korean studies that wasn't basically from one of those four categories.
Right. Okay. And actually, before, like, so basically, like, it was like one month ago I asked you to be on air.
Right.
And then after that, I basically did some research on your professor. And then I found a video. It was like a short document called Urimae Jikimi.
Right.
And then at the beginning, it basically started off with you having being in an interview at the Asian City, in your office at the Asian Studies Department building. And basically, I saw that you saying that in comparison to the Chinese and Japanese language program, the education program, there was not much of it, like enough support, especially the financial support from the Korean government for the Korean language education.
Right.
So, and that was a few years back. So compared to that, the time of the interview, has there been any significant improvement in the support in any way?
Unfortunately, no. And it's not just the Korean government. It's also Korean big business. And I'm not even really sure where to begin answering that question. It's true. I mean, up until about that time, a few years ago, I used to always get asked to do interviews, especially on Hangul-la, you know, October 9th, right? And because on Hangul-la, that's the one day of the year when Koreans kind of put down their English language textbooks and their English language tapes and sort of think for just a few minutes about, oh, yeah, that's right. We have our own language, too. Isn't it great? Rah, rah, Hangul. Hangul, we love Hangul. And then they go around and they interview foreigners. And basically, if you play the game, they want foreigners to sort of go on air, go on tape, go in front of the camera, whatever, and sort of basically gush about how they love kimchi and they love Hangul and they love Korea and they love K-pop. And then, you know, the Koreans listen to that and think, oh, we're so great. And then they go back to studying English. You know, after several interviews like that over a number of years, where I basically refused to play that role, instead, you know, did my standard, you know, sunsori, right? Where I basically said, you know, poured cold water on it and said, look, this is, you know, what's happening, in fact, is that the Korean government is being, and Koreans in general, but especially the government and big business, the chaebol, they are being so short-sighted and so stingy in supporting non-Koreans who want to learn their language and culture, and that this is ultimately, in the long run, going to come back to bite them. Because, you know, that's how you essentially train what the Koreans call a Jihanpa, you know, people who know Korea, or a Chinhanpa, the pro-Korean kind of people. And those are the people who down the road, you know, it's a long-term investment, are going to turn around and actually care about Korea, or maybe, who knows, maybe even, you know, make influential policy decisions about Korea in their home countries, or in one way or another, build bridges, right, between their country, wherever they are, and Korea. So I've been saying this for a while, but it's actually gotten worse in some ways because in the meantime, you know, when I started, well, how long has K-pop been going? Maybe K-pop? 15 years now?
Yeah, pretty much. In North America?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, in general.
In general?
Like, I think 1999? Like
Or like with H.O.T.
Right. So, you know, for the first kind of 5 to 10 years, everybody was really excited about the Koreans. The Koreans like, oh, this is great. That had a couple, I think, negative effects on the way that Koreans think about promoting their culture overseas. And the worst effect has been that I think it has led to a kind of complacency and a kind of smugness and even a kind of arrogance in the sense that, oh, we're so popular, foreigners are just going to shell out their own money and come over here to learn our language and culture. Therefore, we ourselves do not need to make any long-term investments in this. And I think that's still happening. But what has changed in the meantime is that China has suddenly gotten really powerful, really big, is making huge investments of its own in promoting its soft power and its language and so on. They woke up. Like the sleeping dragon kind of woke up, right? Because until about the year 2005, Korean studies, Korean language education did not have to compete with Chinese. Chinese was always there. I mean, China has always been very important just by its size. But the Koreans never really had to. They always thought of themselves as competing with Japanese. And you know, those are two fights that the Koreans are never going to win. And nor should they even think of winning them. It's rather the strategy is just to stay in the game, just to even be on the playing field, right? Because, you know, when I started out, you know, as a student your age, Korea wasn't even on the intellectual map of most North Americans. You know, most universities did not have Korean. Even now, only 1% of North American universities teach Korean. Think about that, right? 1%. It's very small, but that's a huge increase. And so at this point in time, I think the real challenge for Korea and for Koreans everywhere is just to maintain the significant kind of gains that they've made. In order to do that, it's going to require way more investment than they've put into it so far. And then for me, the really big, you know, I've been head now for 11 years, head of department of probably North America's largest Asian studies department. I mean, we have more than 11,000 enrollments a year. And this is across, you know, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, as well as South Asia, even Persian, right, Tibetan. And so I, you know, over the last 10 years, I see these different trends of what students are doing and where the funding is and you know, basically how things are moving. And I'm really worried about the future of Korean studies and Korean language, because what the Japanese did, which was brilliant, was back in the early 1970s already, they started making really serious long-term investments, you know, both through the Japan Foundation, which was founded in 1972, and then also Japanese big companies. And so because of – and they kept pumping money into it until basically the Japanese economy kind of, you know, went south in the 80s. But it was like for almost 20 years. And since then, the Japanese economy has been in the doldrums, like, ever since. And there's not as much support coming out of Japan now. But it doesn't matter because they had built this really, really strong infrastructure for Japanese language education, et cetera. So even here at UBC, if you, like, compare the lists of opportunities for students to go study abroad in Japan for a year to what we have for Korea, it's just night and day. There are very few funded opportunities for students, whether at UBC or in the States, to go to Korea and study Korean. It's just pathetic. And that's something the Japanese did really well. And they put a lot of money into it. And their companies did as well. But right now, Korean companies are still sort of basically masking their Korean identity. So that there's still a lot of people like walking down the street in Vancouver or in any American city who don't even realize that Samsung, you know, Hyundai, LG, that these are Korean companies. Because the companies themselves are not yet sort of comfortable with basically claiming their identity as Korean companies. And so therefore, they have no real kind of incentive to support Korean studies, whereas the Japanese companies embraced their Japanese identity really early and said, if we support Japanese studies, that's good for business. And the Koreans just have not figured that out. And in a way, K-pop has kind of, I think, made them even less inclined to do it, because they just think, oh, we're so popular. And so, more, you know, someday it might crash. Someday K-pop might fizzle out.
Right.
Who knows?
Right. Yeah. Nobody knows.
But
what
anyway,
the
they put all they put the, they've put all their eggs in that basket. The Korea Foundation has a pitifully small budget,
right?
Compared to, I'd say, the Japan Foundation. Even 50 years ago, 50 years ago, the Japan Foundation was giving five times as much money for Japanese studies as the Korea Foundation is giving today for Korean studies. So I think that says a lot. And the Koreans just don't really care. They're just too busy learning English. And as I said, I think they're also just very smug about K-pop.
Right. Would there be anything that would make the Korean language program stronger than Japanese and Chinese program in any way? Like, for example, like the soft power that people have with the K-pop and stuff. Would there be anything
else? Well, so, you know, in some ways it's a really timely moment for I think, Korean companies and government organizations to make a strategic change and to make some strategic investments, to basically capitalize on this interest. Because what happens is students, or anyway, it doesn't have to be students. I mean, kids, sometimes really young, young people, youths in their early teens get interested in K-pop all the way up through their 30s. And what K-pop does is it creates this really intense interest about Korea, about the Korean language, about Korean culture. And many of those fans crave more opportunities to access that culture.
Right.
And but the problem is that there are no opportunities that are funded in the sense that, you know, sure, if you want to pay your own money and come, be our guest kind of thing. And so what we don't have is more funded bursaries to get students over to Korea on exchange for one or two semesters. That kind of thing are very, very thin on the ground.
Right.
So that would be good. But like I say, I don't think it's a fight that the Koreans are ever going to win. I think they have to carve out a niche and just maintain that niche. The niche has now been carved out. But if they're not careful, I think within the next 10 years, it'll disappear.
Right.
It'll be pushed out by Chinese.
Right. And during the talk up until so far, we've done, we basically focused on more of like what the government and also like the Chaebol could do.
Yeah.
Would there be anything else that we could do in the community, like from like a Minganin's
own? Yeah, that's a really good question. I've thought about that for many years. And I mean, the short answer is I really don't think there is. I mean, we were talking earlier before we went on air about the local, you know, newspapers. Like, you work for the Chungang Yilbo. And I've noticed already in the last 10 years, even the local Korean newspapers basically completely ignore what happens at UBC in Korean studies, for example. I mean, we have some really, really prominent scholars publishing really important work, translating, you know, literature, you know, writing great articles, teaching courses on a wide number of subjects. In fact, more than just about any other university in North America, we're definitely in like the top five universities in terms of our sort of Kyosujin, the team of professors we have. And yet the local community is completely oblivious to this. The local Korean community has no idea about it. And that's partly, I suppose, UBC's fault. Professors are not very good at sort of hongbo. We're not promoting. Trained as promoters. We're not trained as development officers. We're trained to be professors. And, you know, we're pretty good at being professors. But I think it's definitely incumbent, for example, on the local newspapers and the press to actually pay more attention and to make sure that the local population knows what's going on, because even just being interested or showing some interest would be nice, because we really feel like we're pretty much ignored. And you know, there has been some financial support now and then from the local community, but the kind of financial support that a local Korean community can muster, unfortunately, is just never at the level or of the scale that makes a difference in a North American university environment. It's really expensive to hire a professor or to, you know, do Korean studies. You know, it's not something that a few thousand dollars is going to change. It has to be millions of dollars. And that kind of money has to come from, you know, big corporations or governments. And so I don't think that kind of money will come from local Korean populations. But it would be nice if at least, you know, the newspapers would occasionally cover what's going on. And like I say, I haven't seen much in the local Korean press for over a decade. They've just basically walked away. And I mean, that I don't read the local papers myself very often, but that's my impression. And of course, I mean, what would be really good would be if more students came and took our classes, but not just Korean students, anybody. I mean, whoever wants. And we do have quite a diverse range of students taking our classes. Our Korean studies courses do pretty well.
Shall we continue this conversation after we listen to some music?
Of course.
Yeah. Awesome. So we're going to listen to some songs, maybe two songs, and also come back after listening to the advertisement 광고. And yeah, we'll be right back. Make sure to stay tuned in. Professor Ross King is here with us today. And we're going to listen to BB by Aya from the album BB, and coming followed by Deja Vu by Newest from their album Who You.
Back balance. It's me, 나예요, 다를 거 없이. 요즘에 뭔가요, 내 가슴. 탐색하는 불빛. Scanner. 오늘은 몇 점인가요? Jealous. 쟤는 대체 왜 저런 옷을 좋아한담? 기분을 알 수 없는 표정은 뭐람? 내가 달라진 건 아마 스트레스 때문인가? 걱정요, 쟤도 참. Yellow CARD. 비밀이 뭔지 전부 다의 사정 역시 정중히 사양할게요 Not my business 이대로 좋아요 Talk less Still me 너의 오늘 날 거 없이 I'm sure you're gonna say my gosh 바빠지는 눈빛 Checking 매일 틀린 그림 찾기 Oh hashtagging 꿋꿋하게 걷다가 삐끗 넘어질라 다들 수군대는 걸 자기는 하나 몰라 여기서 발이 반개를 어울린다나 문제야 자꾸 참 Yellow CARD
난 널 그리워하고 넌 날 기다리게 해 아름답도록 아픈 내 맘을 너로 만들고 무너져 나는
깊은 멈추고 기억이 뒤바뀐 뒤로 기억을 걷는 이곳에 차라리 날 가둬줘 데자뷰 시간을 나도 모르게 속여 계속 멈춰있어줘 데자뷰
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
You're listening to K-Pop Cafe on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam Territory located in British Columbia, and we are here with our special guest today, Professor Ross King. So, Professor, so during our talk earlier, we both mentioned a few things about Hallyu, the Korean Wave, and also the media stuff, like the media power, and the influence from all the media very shortly, saying that it had got some people interested and passionate in learning Korean, but also in a way it made some people in Korea, like, in a way, like, ignorant, thinking, oh, we're so popular, and kind of, in a way, making them not passionate enough to, like, promote the Korean language program or invest more in the program. So let's put that on the side for a second, and then let's focus more on the actual influence of the soft meat, a soft power for a bit now. So how do you think Hallyu, the Korean Wave, I think everyone knows this term now, Hallyu, has impacted on the education system or like the people demand on?
Well, interest. I mean, it's very clear. I was just at a conference last weekend down at Stanford in Palo Alto about the future of Korean studies. And there was a whole panel dedicated to Korean language education where everybody was basically talking about you know, Hallyu and its effect on enrollments.
Right.
And we've seen this for the last, you know, 5 years and more now. Mm-hmm. First of all, the Modern Language Association, the MLA in the United States, keeps statistics on enrollments in foreign languages, all foreign languages, every year across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And Korean has been, you know, the fastest growing foreign language in the United States now for some years.
Oh, really?
For 2 or 3 years, yeah. Oh. I mean, it's jumped like 45%, in a very short period of time. And, and that's all Hallyu.
Right.
And then there's similar. I was after I was in Korea last year.
Mm-hmm.
I spent 1 month in May. The whole month of May, I was in Paris. And Europe is seeing very similar kinds of things. In some ways, in Europe, it's even more dramatic because these sleepy little universities that used to have these small Korean language programs at the University of Paris, the Paris 7, as well as in Venice, in Italy, places like this have had an explosion of interest, all in Korean language. Hundreds of students showing up
the
first day to register for a Korean language. The problem is that they disappear within 1 or 2 semesters.
Oh, really?
And this is what no one talks about. So, you know, the Korean press is kind of crowing about this all the time. Look how popular we are. Oh,
right.
K-pop is so great. You know, and again, this feeds this notion that therefore we don't need to invest in it. But what they don't tell you is that, you know, within literally 12 months, most of those students have disappeared. Because on the one hand, they find it's just too difficult. And then they're not really prepared to make the investment themselves in terms of time and effort that it really takes to learn Korean properly.
Right.
But also, I think they also realize that there's really no path ahead of them. There's no, there are no incentives. There are no opportunities for them, you know, to easily, without sort of going into debt, go to Korea for a year and study in Korea without paying their own money. Whereas in other language fields like Japanese or Chinese or whatever, German, I mean, the German government puts tons of money into foreigners coming to Germany to learn German, for example. It's just not there for Koreans. So I think what happens is that, you know, the K-pop generates this intense interest. But if you're not actually providing an infrastructure to kind of support it once the student comes in the door to make sure that they're still there after 1 or 2 semesters, it just kind of goes up in smoke. And we're seeing that. I mean, our enrollments in our Korean program at UBC have doubled, but over the last, say, 9 years, which is pretty good.
Right.
And so we have, you know, we're not quite at the point where we have so many students on our wait list that we have to hire a new instructor. But we do have wait lists now, which we never used to do. I mean, so we've seen as well an increase in our numbers, and it's mostly due to K-pop. And at UBC, partly just because of our demographics, 80% of the students taking Korean are of Chinese background.
Right.
But, you know, that can mean anything. That could be, it could be, you know, from the PRC, and here's international students. They could be fourth generation Vancouver Chinese. They could be from Hong Kong or Taiwan. It's very diverse. And yet that is kind of special to Vancouver or to UBC, but not unique, because across North America, I think you'll find that a lot of those enrollments in Koreans, a lot of those increased enrollments are from students from more of an Asian heritage background.
Right.
And that also, I think, paradoxically leads to less interest on the part of Korean funding authorities to support Korean studies, because they're so kind of racist in the way they think about this. It's like they want white people to learn Korean.
Right.
And it's like, you know, oh, but if it's a bunch of Chinese or non-whites, let's do something else. And they end up putting all their money, and this is a slightly different argument, but in countries, in situations that are actually supplying labor to South Korea. So that would be Indonesia, Vietnam, Central Asia. Down there, where K-pop's also very popular, but where if you actually learn Korean, it can actually get you hired in a decent job with a Korean company, which is not the case in North America. So the dynamics in terms of the economic value of Korean are different in North America. So you, there's a lot of complex factors at play, but it is a fact that yes, it increases demand for our courses. It does bring more students into classes, not just language classes, but classes about Korea.
Right.
But as a field, we as a field in Korean studies, and I think Korea as a nation, Korean companies as kind of a collective entity, have not yet figured out how to really capitalize on that increased interest and make and convert those into, for example, majors or whatever.
Right.
The number of students majoring in Korean at UBC is completely flat, has not changed at all. And this is true right across the country. My colleague who teaches Korean down at UCLA, which is the single largest Korean program in all of North America, because there are tons of Koreans in LA. She was also saying they have a huge problem with attrition, that for every five students in first year Korean, there's only one student in fourth year Korean at UCLA. And that's pretty true everywhere. So this is something that I think needs, that's where you need these increased opportunities, these increased bursaries or scholarships, incentives to get students to commit more long term than just sort of dipping their toe in the water for maybe a semester, maybe 1 year, and then going somewhere else.
Right. And if we were to narrow down the focus of Hallyu in more in North America. So if we compare it to the East Asia, so for example in China and also Japan, so like the Hallyu has been like around there for almost 2 years so far. In China it started over there, and then in Japan when Winter Sonata Gyeol Hyeonga hit like stroke Japan back in 2004, I think it was all like I was back in Korea as well. I was in like grade four back then. It was really shocking for like pretty much everyone that. Like the country where we've been having like you know like social problems and also political problems conflicts with, like are now also looking at like consuming our media and also like Korean media and that was really shocking for me for us as well and that kind of led as a result to the growth of the Korean language program in Asia as well including China and Japan. But then for a while, so there has been like three phases for Korean language. So phase one, like that was like late 1980s, and phase two, that was early 20s. And then phase three is what we are having right now. We're seeing that a little bit more globalized. So it's also getting popular in North America as it has been popular in Asia. So has there been like a specific like turning point? Like you said, it's actually Korean language program is actually having recording the fastest growth rate here and also in Europe as well. Has there been like a specific like turning point at some point?
It's hard to, I certainly can't put my finger on any specific turning point, but the increased enrollments are definitely within the last, I would say, 6 to 8 years. The problem is that the statistics that we get from the MLA only come out every, I think, 4 or 5 years.
Right.
So it's hard to find where it suddenly, you know, you get the uptick. But I would say this, you know, I in the summers I'm involved with the Korean Language Village, which is a program in Minnesota for young people, 7 to 18, ages 7 to 18. And we've been doing that since 1999. And that gets learners from all over the United States. It's a national program. And we saw the uptick already before K-pop became mainstream. In other words, before the Korean press noticed that K-pop was kind of becoming a thing in North America. We were already seeing it in the village with you know young people coming to us wanting to learn Korean and saying it was because of Korean pop music. But these were typically, they were either Hispanic Americans, they were Asian heritage Americans, and also African Americans, which are populations that, again, the Koreans don't care about back in Korea. And so it was already happening in those demographics. And we could see this on the ground because these kids would come to us from random places, you know, and just really fired up to learn Korean. And in that fact, they came to us having self-taught. I mean, they're highly motivated learners.
Wow.
And so this is the problem. You get these really highly motivated, high-achieving kids already, like, you know, from age 13 who are, you know, that's when you want to seize it. That's the moment to kind of grab them and then turn them into kind of long-term, lifetime learners of Korean and basically lifetime, you know, kind of friends of Korea. But and if you don't have a strategy, you know, as a nation, as the Korean nation or as Korean companies or even as, say, you know, you know, like Korean Americans and Korean Canadians, to basically convert that kind of interest into something more long term, that's a huge loss, I think, for everybody. But my point is here that we were seeing this before the Korean media were saying, oh, now finally K-pop has made it big in the U.S. Because for them, that only really happened when white people started listening to it and when certain performers were actually making it on the charts. Kind of thing. But it was already happening underneath, you know, under the table kind of thing in other demographics in the United States. So I think that's a point that has been missed.
I see. Yeah,
and that's early 2000s.
Early 2000s. That's been
starting. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So almost like 15 years or 18 years.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. Awesome. So everyone, make sure to stay tuned right in. We'll be back right after we listen to one more song and maybe show promotions and maybe PSA. And we'll be right back.
Tune in to La Fiesta every other Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. with your host, Nick Arana. Listen to internationally acclaimed musica latina caliente that makes your body move and your heart beat.
After decades of decline, drowning fatalities have been rising dramatically in Canada since 2004. Most drowning victims had no intention of going in the water, and harmless situations can become dangerous quickly. This summer, if you're going out on the water, even if you're not planning on going in it, be water smart and be prepared. Here are some things you can do to reduce your risk of drowning. Learn to swim and swim to survive. If you can tread water for a minute, you can orient yourself, and if you can swim 50 meters in a pool, you'll most likely be able to swim to safety in open water. Most drowning fatalities occur within just 15 meters of safety. Wear a life jacket or personal flotation device. 80% of all boating deaths were people who were not wearing one. Take a marine safety course, and if you're going kayaking or canoeing, know how to get out of your craft if it flips over. Practice basic safety moves such as wet exits and self-rescues. Save the alcohol for dry land after you're done playing on the water, and never go out alone. For more information and more safety tips, go to lifesaving.bc.ca.
Okay, so that was Travel by Bygone 4. And Professor, could you please tell us about the language village program that you mentioned earlier?
Sure. It's called Supsogehosu, which means Lake of the Woods, and it's one of 15 different language villages in northern Minnesota, part of something called Concordia Language Villages. It's not for profit. It's been going since 1961, and it's basically summer camp, like Boy Scout camp or Girl Scout camp, except everything is in the target language. Everything's in Korean. The food's all Korean. All the staff speak Korean. Everything is done in Korean, and it's an extremely effective way to get young people interested, you know, enthusiastic about the target language and culture. And actually, it's way more effective than learning language in a classroom. And so the Korean Language Village, I mean, I think I mentioned earlier that I attended those villages as a child myself. That's where I learned Russian and German and Spanish. I launched the Korean village, Supsogehosu, in 1999. So we celebrated our 20th anniversary of programming last summer. One of our major benefactors and donors gave us $5 million earlier this year to start building a sort of an architecturally authentic or Korean-looking village, our own sort of site. We have a big property in Minnesota around a big lake. And so we'll be doing that. But we're always, something your listeners might be interested in, some of them, we're always looking for staff. We're looking for people who are speakers of Korean, and I don't mean native speakers of Korean. They don't have to be native-speaking Koreans. I definitely don't believe, as you can imagine, as someone who's not ethnically Korean myself, I do not believe in the native speaker myth. I don't think that native speakers are the only speakers or people who can teach a language. So we also hire non-ethnically, you know, Korean staff. The key is that they have to have skills that they have to have kid skills. They have to have camp skills, summer camp skills. They have to be either musicians, guitar players, singers, athletes, dancers, whatever. And, you know, you're with young people 24/7 modeling Korean for them. And it's a great work experience. We provide the J-1 visa for non-U.S. citizens. So Canadians can work, Koreans can work. And it's actually also for learners of Korean, as long as your Korean is at a minimum certain level, say at least 3 or 4 years worth of say, university level, it is really good for your Korean. It's actually many of our staff who are not ethnically Korean report that their Korean improves more working for 5 weeks on staff than when they go to Korea for several months because all the Koreans want to speak English with them. So, you know, it's a really great rewarding, not financially rewarding, but otherwise in every way rewarding work experience, working with young people and sharing with them Korean language and culture. And so this will be our 21st summer next summer. And they start hiring staff in January. And if you just go online to concordialanguagevillages.org, you can find a staff application.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll also look into that as well personally myself.
Please do.
Yes. And Professor, last question I have for you is, please share your opinions about the future of the Korean language program. Where do you see it 10 years from now?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about high school level, I'm actually really worried about it, especially in the United States. Well, both U.S. and Canada. Right now in the United States, if a high school teaches a foreign language, it's basically Spanish, and which is not even a foreign language anymore in the United States. And then if they're lucky, they might have one other language, and if they do 10 years from now, it's going to be Chinese. So I think Korean is going to be shut out of high schools in the United States. In Canada, it's actually even more difficult for Korean because English competes with French in Canadian schools. And all languages other than English and French do have a difficult time sort of establishing a foothold in Canadian schools. So that leaves post-secondary. So that means, you know, what can you do at the college level? There, one thing I really would like to see, again, I would like to see Korean at least just maintain its current niche, which I think will be difficult without further investment. But one thing that, and you had asked this earlier, what could, you know, local Koreans do? You know, a school like university like UBC has robust bilateral student mobility agreements with universities like Seoulde, Korea University, Yonsei University, Ewha Women's University, Sungkyunkwan University. So where in theory, you know, students can go back and forth. You know, if a UBC student goes, then one comes from there, that kind of thing, you know, one for one. The problem is that very few students take advantage of this really amazing opportunity. And part of the reason that they don't take advantage of it is that it's expensive because, you know, if they're in Vancouver, usually they're living at home with their parents. They don't pay rent. They might have a part-time job. You know, their mom's cooking for them. I mean, their expenses are low. And to get beyond that initial reticence to do an abroad, study abroad opportunity, you need a few thousand dollars, you know, of a kind of bursary. And that's exactly what we do not have for Korean, is that kind of lower level. Just a few thousand bucks is all it takes to change a student's life and convince them, oh, maybe it won't be, I won't have to go into debt if I go to Seoul for a year. I would love to see more of our students taking advantage of those kinds of opportunities, which exist on paper and bureaucratically, administratively, are really easy to do. But they just don't do it for a really, because of a low level kind of financial barrier. And then the flip side of that is that, you know, the more that UBC sends over to Korean partner universities, the more that more Koreans get the opportunity to come study at UBC. And so one of the things I've been trying to do is work with some of the local alumni groups for the different Korean universities that we have agreements with. But, you know, the problem there is, because they always do, like, every year they all do, like, a golf tournament, and they raise some money, and then they always give it to their church. Because the churches in the Korean community basically control everything. And, you know, that's fine. That's a good use of funds. But the other problem is that they tend to where was I going with this? Yeah, the leadership changes every year. So you never know from one year to the next who the right person is to contact. And so it's really hard to get a long-term commitment going with some of the alumni groups for, like, you know, Kode, Yonde, Seoulde, to help them help their hubae come to UBC to study by giving scholarships to UBC students to go study in Korea. So that's one sort of really concrete example of a low-level, fairly easy thing to do that would really help, I think, increase exchange back and forth. So, yeah, 10 years from now, I hope we're still maintaining the same level of interest, but that we're finding ways to convert that interest into long-term commitments to learning Korean rather than losing a lot of the students after a couple of semesters.
Okay, awesome. And now it's time for me to wrap things up actually today. And it was really great to have you, Professor, here today. And
thanks,
it was really
an honor
for me. I hope you can come back on air later as well.
Anytime,
If you'd be willing to do that, of course, you're always welcome here.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on air today, Professor. Yes. Hi, guys. So I'll leave you with Heavy Eyes by Basement Revolver, and I'll see you guys next week.